This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents The Keeper of Lost Things, a novel by Ruth Hogan, performed by Jane Collingwood and Sandra Duncan. Chapter 1. Charles Bramwell Broccoli was travelling alone and without a ticket on the 1442 from London Bridge to Brighton. The Huntley and Palmer's biscuit tin in which he was travelling teetered precariously on the edge of the seat as the train juddered to a halt at Hayward's Heath. But just as it toppled forward towards the carriage floor, it was gathered up by a safe pair of hands. He was glad to be home. Padua was a solid red-brick Victorian villa with honeysuckle and clematis framing the steeply pitched porch. The cool, rose-scented, echoing space of the entrance hall welcomed the man inside from the relentless glare of the afternoon sun. He put down his bag, replaced his keys in the drawer of the hall table, and hung his Panama on the hat stand. He was weary to the bone, but the quiet house soothed him. Quiet, but not silent. There was the steady tick of a long-case clock and the distant hum of an ancient refrigerator, and somewhere in the garden a blackbird sang. But the house was untainted by the tinnitus of technology. There was no computer, no television, no DVD or CD player. The only connections to the outside world were an old bakelite telephone in the hall and a radio. In the kitchen he let the tap run until the water was icy cold and then filled a tumbler. It was too early for gin and lime, and too hot for tea. Laura had gone home for the day, but she had left a note and a ham salad in the refrigerator for his supper. Dear girl. He gulped the water down. Back in the hall, he took a single key from his trouser pocket and unlocked a heavy oak door. He retrieved his bag from the floor and entered the room, closing the door softly behind him. Shelves and drawers, shelves and drawers, shelves and drawers. Three walls were completely obscured, and every shelf was laden and every drawer was full with a sad Salmagundi of 40 years gathered in, labelled and given a home. Lace panels dressed the French windows and diffused the brash light from the afternoon sun. A single shaft from the space between them pierced the gloom, glittering with specks of dust. The man took the Huntley and Palmer's biscuit tin from his bag and placed it carefully on a large mahogany table, the only clear surface in the room. Lifting the lid, he inspected the contents, a pale grey substance, the texture of coarse-grained sand. He had scattered the like many years ago in the rose garden at the back of the house. But surely these could not be human remains, not left on a train in a biscuit tin. He replaced the lid. He had tried to hand them in at the station, but the ticket collector, cocksure that it was just litter, suggested that he put it in the nearest bin.
"You'd be amazed at the rubbish people leave on trains," he said, dismissing Anthony with a shrug.
Nothing surprised Anthony any more. But loss always moved him, however great or small. From a drawer, he took a brown paper luggage label and a gold-nibbed fountain pen. He wrote carefully in black ink the date and time and the place, very specific.
Huntley and Palmer's biscuit tin, containing cremation remains, found 6th carriage from the front, 1442 train from London Bridge to Brighton. Deceased unknown. God bless. And rest in peace.
He stroked the lid of the tin tenderly, before finding a space on one of the shelves, and gently sliding the tin into position. The chime of the clock in the hall said time for gin and lime. He took ice cubes and lime juice from the refrigerator and carried them through to the garden room on a silver drinks tray with a green cocktail glass and a small dish of olives. He wasn't hungry, but he hoped they might awaken his appetite. He didn't want to disappoint Laura by leaving her carefully prepared salad. He set the tray down and opened the window into the garden at the back of the house. The gramophone player was a handsome wooden affair with a sweeping golden horn. He lifted the needle and placed it gently onto the licorice-coloured disc. The voice of Al Bowley floated up through the air and out into the garden to compete with the blackbird. The very thought of you. It had been their song. He released his long, loose limbs into the comfort of a leather wing-backed chair. In his prime, his bulk had matched his height, and he had been an impressive figure, but old age had diminished the flesh, and now skin lay much closer to bones. His glass in one hand, he toasted the woman whose silver-framed photograph he held in the other. "Chin Chin, my darling girl." He took a sip from his drink and lovingly, longingly kissed the cold glass of the photograph before replacing it on the side table next to his chair. She was not a classic beauty. A young woman with wavy hair and large dark eyes that shone even in an old black-and-white photograph. But she was wonderfully striking, with a presence that still reached out from all those years ago and captivated him. She had been dead for 40 years, but she was still his life, and her death had given him his purpose. It had made Anthony Perdue the keeper of lost things. Chapter 2. Laura had been lost, hopelessly adrift, kept afloat, but barely, by an unhappy combination of Prozac, Pinot Grigio, and pretending things weren't happening. Things like Vince's affair. Anthony Perdue and his house had saved her. As she pulled up and parked outside the house, she calculated how long she had worked there. 5? No, almost 6 years. She had been sitting in her doctor's waiting room, anxiously flicking through the magazines, when an advertisement in The Lady had caught her attention. Housekeeper/personal assistant required for gentleman writer. Please apply in writing to Anthony Perdue, P.O. Box 27312. She had entered the waiting room intending to plead for more drugs to make her unhappy existence more bearable, and left it determined to apply for a position that would, it turned out, transform her life. As she turned her key in the lock and stepped through the front door, the peace of the house embraced her as it always did. She went through to the kitchen, filled the kettle, and set it on the hob. Anthony would be out on his morning walk. She hadn't seen him at all yesterday. He had been to London to see his solicitor. Waiting for the kettle to boil, she leafed through the neat pile of paperwork he had left for her to deal with. A few bills to pay, some letters to answer on his behalf, and a request to make an appointment with his doctor. She felt a prickle of anxiety. She had tried not to see him fading over the past months, like a fine portrait left too long in harsh sunlight, losing clarity and colour. When he had interviewed her all those years ago, he had been a tall, muscular man with a full head of dark hair, tanzanite eyes, and a voice like James Mason. She had thought him much younger than his 68 years. Laura had fallen in love with both Mr. Perdue and the house moments after stepping through the door. The love she felt for him was not the romantic kind, but more the love of a child for a favourite uncle. His gentle strength, tranquil manner, and immaculate urbanity were all qualities that she had learned, albeit a little late, to appreciate in a man. His presence always lifted her spirits and made her value her life in a way that she hadn't for a very long time. He was a comforting constant, like Radio 4, Big Ben, and Land of Hope and Glory, but always very slightly distant. There was a part of himself which he never revealed, a secret always kept. Laura was glad. Intimacy, both physical and emotional, had always been a disappointment to her. Mr. Perdue was the perfect employer who had become Anthony a dear friend, but one who never came too close. As for Padua, It was the tray cloth that made Laura fall in love with the house. Anthony had made her tea at her interview. He had brought it into the garden room, teapot with cozy, milk jug, sugar bowl and tongs, cups and saucers, silver teaspoons, tea strainer and stand, all set out on a tray with a tray cloth. Pure white, lace-edged linen. The tray cloth was definitive. Padua was clearly a house where all these things, including the tray cloth, were part of everyday life. And Mr. Pergy was a man whose everyday life was exactly the kind that Laura longed for. When they were first married, Vince had teased her about her attempts to introduce such things into their own home. If he was ever forced to make his own tea, he abandoned the used tea bag on the draining board, no matter how many times Laura asked him to put it in the bin. He drank milk and fruit juice straight from the carton, ate with his elbows on the table, held his knife like a pen, and spoke with his mouth full. Each on its own was a small thing, like the many other small things he did and said that Laura tried to ignore, but nonetheless chafed her soul. Over the years, their accumulation in both number and frequency hardened Laura's heart and stymied her gentle aspirations for even modest fragments of the life she had once sampled in the homes of her school friends. When Vince's teasing eventually curdled into mocking, a tray cloth to him became an object worthy only of derision, and so did Laura. The interview had taken place on the day of her 35th birthday, and had been surprisingly brief. Mr. Pardew had asked her how she took her tea, and then poured it. There had been precious few other questions from either party before he had offered Laura the job, and she had accepted. It had been the perfect present, and the beginning of hope for Laura. The whistle of the kettle pierced her reminiscence. Laura took her tea, along with a duster and some polish, through to the garden room. She hated cleaning at home, especially when she had shared a home with Vince, but here it was an act of love. When she had first arrived, the house and its contents were gently neglected, not dirty or shabby, just vaguely overlooked. Many of the rooms were unused. Anthony spent most of his time in the garden room or his study, and never had any guests to stay in the extra bedrooms. Softly, gently, room by room, Laura had loved the house back into life. Except the study. She had never been in the study. Anthony had told her at the start that nobody went into the study except him, and when he wasn't in there, it was kept locked. She had never questioned it. But all the other rooms were kept clean and bright and ready for anyone to enjoy, even if no one ever came. In the garden room, Laura picked up the silver-framed photograph and buffed the glass and silver until it shone. Anthony had told her that the woman's name was Therese, and Laura knew that he must have loved her very much, because hers was one of only three photographs on display throughout the whole house. The others were copies of a picture of Anthony and Therese together, one of which he kept on a small table next to his bed, and the other on the dressing table in the big bedroom at the back of the house. In all the years she had known him, she had never seen him look as happy in life as he did in that photograph. When Laura left Vince, the last thing she had done was to chuck the large framed photograph of their wedding into the bin, but not before she had stamped on it, grinding the smashed glass into his smirking face with her heel. Selina from Servicing was welcome to him. He was a complete and utter arsehole. It was the first time she had really admitted it, even to herself. It didn't make her feel any better. It just made her sad that she had wasted so many years with him. But with an unfinished education, no real work experience, and no other means of supporting herself, there had been little choice. When she had finished in the garden room, Laura went through to the hallway and started up the stairs, stroking a golden gleam from the curved wooden banister with her duster as she went. She had often wondered about the study. Of course she had. but she respected Anthony's privacy as he respected hers. Upstairs, the largest bedroom was also the handsomest and had a bay window that overlooked the back garden. It was the room Anthony had once shared with Thérèse, but now he slept in the smaller room next door. Laura opened the window to let in some air. The roses in the garden below were in full bloom, undulating ruffles of scarlet, pink, and creamy petals, and the surrounding borders frothed with fluttering peonies punctuated with sapphire lances of larkspur. The scent of the roses floated upwards on the warm air, and Laura breathed deeply, taking in the heady perfume. But this room always smelled of roses, even in midwinter, when the garden was frozen and asleep and the windows sealed with frost. Laura straightened and stroked the already perfect bed covers and plumped the cushions on the ottoman. The green glass dressing table set sparkled in the sunlight, but was lovingly dusted nonetheless. But not everything in the room was perfect. The little blue enameled clock had stopped again. 11:55, and no ticking. Every day it stopped at the same time. Laura checked her watch and reset the hands on the clock. She carefully wound the small key until the soft ticking resumed, and then returned it to its place on the dressing table. The sound of the front door closing signalled Anthony's return from his walk. It was followed by the unlocking, opening, and closing of the study door. It was a sequence of sounds with which Laura was very familiar. In the kitchen, she made a pot of coffee that she set out on a tray with a cup and saucer, a silver jug of cream, and a plate of digestive biscuits. She took it through to the hall and knocked gently on the study door, and when it was opened, passed the tray to Anthony. He looked tired, etiolated rather than invigorated by his walk.
"Thank you, my dear."
She noticed unhappily that his hands shook slightly as he took the tray from hers. "Is there anything in particular that you'd like for lunch?" she asked coaxingly.
"No, no. I'm sure whatever you decide will be delicious."
The door closed. Back in the kitchen, Laura washed up the dirty mug that had appeared in the sink, left no doubt by Freddy, the gardener. He had started working at Padua a couple of years ago, but their paths rarely crossed, which was disappointing for Laura, as she had the feeling that she might like to get to know him better. He was tall and dark, but not so handsome as to be a cliché. He had a faint scar which ran vertically between his nose and top lip, and puckered his mouth a little on one side, but somehow its effect was to add, rather than detract, giving his smile a particular lopsided charm. He was affable enough when they did bump into one another, but no more so than politeness demanded, giving Laura little encouragement to pursue his friendship. Laura started on the pile of paperwork. She would take the letters home with her and type them on her laptop. When she had first worked for Anthony, she used to proofread his manuscripts and type them on an old electric typewriter, but he had stopped writing several years ago now, and she missed it. When she was younger, she had thought about writing as a career, novels or maybe journalism. She had had all sorts of plans. She was a clever girl, with a scholarship to the local girls' school, followed by a place at university. She could have, should have, made a proper life for herself. But instead, she met Vince. At 17, she was still vulnerable, unformed, unsure of her own worth. She was happy at school, but the scholarship meant that she was always slightly displaced. Her factory worker father and shop assistant mother were so proud of their clever daughter. Money was found, scraped together, to buy every item of her expensive school uniform, unheard of unnecessaries like indoor and outdoor shoes. Everything had to be new, nothing second-hand for their girl, and she was grateful. Truly she was. She knew only too well the sacrifices that her parents had made. But it wasn't enough. Being bright and beautifully presented was never quite enough for her to slip seamlessly into the society of those who formed the rank and file of the school's assembly. Girls for whom holidays abroad, trips to the theatre, supper parties and sailing weekends were commonplace. Of course she made friends, girls who were kind and generous, and she accepted their invitations to stay at grand houses with their kind and generous parents. Grand houses where tea was served in pots, toast in racks, butter in dishes, milk in jugs, and jam with a silver spoon. Houses with names instead of numbers, that had terraces, tennis courts, and topiary. And tray cloths. She saw a different kind of life and was enchanted. Her hopes were raised. At home, the milk in a bottle, the marge in a tub, the sugar in a bag, and the tea in a mug were all stones in her pockets, weighing her down. At 17, she had fallen into the space between the two worlds, and there was nowhere left she truly belonged. And then she met Vince. He was older, handsome, cocksure and ambitious. She was flattered by his attentions and impressed by his certainty. Vince was certain about everything. He even had a nickname for himself, Vince the Invincible. He was a car dealer and drove a red Jaguar E-Type, a cliché on wheels. Laura's parents were quietly distraught. They had hoped that her education would be the key to a better life for her, better than theirs, a life with more living and less struggling. They may not have understood about tray cloths, but they knew that the kind of life they wished for Laura was about more than just money. For Laura, it was never about the money. For Vince the Invincible, it was only ever about money and status. Laura's father soon had his own private nickname for Vince Darby, VD. Unhappy years later, Laura often wondered what it was that Vince had seen in her. She was a pretty girl, but not beautiful, and certainly not the teeth, tits, and ass combination he usually favoured. The kind of girls Vince normally dated dropped their knickers as naturally as they dropped their H's. Perhaps he had seen her as a challenge, or a novelty. Whatever it was enough for him to think that she would make him a good wife. Eventually, she came to suspect that his marriage proposal was driven as much by his desire for status as it was by physical desire. Vince had plenty of money, but alone it wasn't enough to get him into the Freemasons or elected chair of the golf club. With her beautiful manners and private school education, Laura was intended to bring a sheen of social sophistication to his brass. He was to be bitterly disappointed. But not as much as Laura. When she first found out about Vince's affair, it had been easy to blame him for everything, to cast him as some Austenesque cad about town with Laura as the virtuous heroine left at home to knit spare toilet roll covers or sew ribbons on her bonnet. But somewhere deep down, Laura knew that that was really fiction. Desperate for refuge from an unsatisfactory reality, she had asked her doctor for antidepressants, but he had insisted that she see a counsellor before handing over the drugs. For Laura, it was a means to an end. She fully expected to run rings round a mousy, middle-aged polyester Pamela to procure her prescription. What she got was a sassy, sharp-suited blonde called Rudy, who forced her to face some rather unpalatable facts. She told Laura to listen to the voice inside her head, the one that pointed out inconvenient truths and raised uncomfortable arguments. Rudy called it engaging with her internal linguistics and said that it would be a very gratifying experience for Laura. Laura called it consorting with the truth fairy and found it as gratifying as listening to her favourite record with a deep scratch in it. The truth fairy had a very suspicious nature. She accused Laura of buckling under the weight of parental expectations, of marrying Vince in part to avoid going to university. In her opinion, Laura was afraid of going to university in case she failed, afraid to stand on her own two feet in case she fell flat on her face. She also raised the unhappy memory of Laura's miscarriage and subsequent almost obsessive and ultimately unsuccessful quest for a baby. In truth, the truth fairy unsettled Laura. But when she got her Prozac, she had stopped listening. The clock in the hallway struck one, and Laura began gathering ingredients for lunch. She beat eggs and cheese together with fresh herbs from the garden, tipped the mixture into a hot pan on the stove, and watched it froth and bubble, and then settle into a fluffy golden omelette. The tray was set with a crisp white linen napkin, a silver knife and fork, and a glass of elderflower cordial. At the door of the study, she swapped it with Anthony for the remains of his morning coffee. The biscuits had not been touched.
Chapter 3. Eunice. 40 years earlier, May 1974. She had decided on the cobalt blue trilby. Her grandmother had once told her that one could blame ugliness on one's genes and ignorance on one's education, but there was absolutely no excuse whatsoever for being dull. School had been dull. Eunice had been a clever girl, but restless, too bored in lessons to do well. She wanted excitement, a life less lifeless. The office where she worked was dull, full of dull people, and so too was her job. Endless typing and filing. Respectable, her parents called it, but that was just another word for dull. Her only escape was in films and books. She read as though her life depended on it. Eunice had seen the advertisement in The Lady. Assistant required for established publisher. Wages woeful, but work never dull. The job was obviously meant for her, and she applied the same day. Her interview was at 12:15 p.m., and she had allowed herself plenty of time to get there, so now she could walk the remainder of the way at her leisure, gathering in the sights and sounds of the city to furnish future memories. The streets were crowded, and Eunice drifted through the homogeneous flow of humanity, occasionally struck by a figure who, for some reason, bobbed above the surface of the indeterminate tide. She nodded at the whistling waiter, sweeping the pavement outside the Swish Fish restaurant, and swerved to avoid an unpleasant collision with a fat and sweaty tourist, too busy studying her A to Z to watch where she was going. She noticed and smiled at the tall man waiting on the corner of Great Russell Street, because he looked nice, but worried. In the moment she passed him, she gathered in everything about him. He was well-built and handsome, with blue eyes and the bearing of a good man. He was anxiously checking his watch and looking up and down the street. He was clearly waiting for someone, and they were late. Eunice was still early. It was only 11:55 a.m. She strolled on. Her thoughts drifted to the approaching interview and interviewer. She hoped that he would look like the man she had left waiting on the corner. But perhaps it would be a woman. A sharp, spiky, unfolded paperclip of a woman with black bobbed hair and red lipstick. As she reached the glossed green door of the address she had been given on Bloomsbury Street, she barely noticed the crowd gathered on the pavement opposite and the distant keen of a siren. She pressed the buzzer and waited. Back straight, feet together, head held high. She heard the sound of footsteps bounding downstairs, and the door was flung open. Eunice fell in love with the man as soon as she saw him. His physical components were individually unremarkable. Medium height, medium build, light brown hair, pleasant face, two eyes and ears, one nose and mouth. But in composition they were magically transformed into a masterpiece. He grasped her hand as though to save her from drowning, and pulled her up the stairs behind him. Breathless with exertion and enthusiasm, he greeted her on the way up with, "You must be Eunice. Delighted to meet you. Call me Bomber. Everyone does." The office that they burst into at the top of the stairs was large and light and very well organized. Shelves and drawers lined the walls, and three filing cabinets stood beneath the window. Eunice was intrigued to see that they were labeled Tom, Dick, and Harry. "Off to the tunnels," Bomber explained, following her gaze and registering the query on her face. The query remained, The Great Escape? Steve McQueen, Dickie Attenborough, bags of dirt, barbed wire, and a motorbike? Eunice smiled. You have seen it, haven't you? Bloody marvellous. He began whistling the theme music. Eunice was resolute. This was definitely the job for her. She would chain herself to one of the filing cabinets if necessary to secure it. Fortunately, it wasn't. The fact that she had seen The Great Escape and was a fan was apparently enough. Bomber made them a pot of tea in the tiny kitchen that adjoined the office to celebrate her appointment. A strange rolling rattle followed him back into the room. The sound was made by a small tan and white terrier, with one ear at half-mast and a brown patch over his left eye. He was seated on a wooden trolley affair with two wheels and pulled himself along by walking with his front legs. Meet Douglas, my right-hand man. Well, dog? Good afternoon, Douglas. Eunice greeted him solemnly. Barter, I presume? Bomber thumped the table with delight. I knew right away that you were the one. Now, how do you like your tea? Over tea and biscuits, Douglas drank his from a saucer. Eunice learned that Bomber had found Douglas abandoned as a puppy after he had been hit by a car. The vet had advised that he be put to sleep, but Bomber had brought him home instead. I made the jalopy myself. It's more Morris Thousand Traveller than Mercedes, but it does the job. They agreed that Eunice would start the following week, on a salary that was perfectly adequate, rather than woeful, and that her duties would include just about anything that needed doing. Eunice was euphoric. But just as she was gathering her things to leave, the door burst open, and the unfolded paperclip woman strode into the room. She was an inelegant zigzag of nose, elbows and knees, unsoftened by any cushioning flesh, and with a face which had over the years sunk into a permanent sneer. "I see that deformed little rat of yours is still alive," she exclaimed, gesturing at Douglas with her cigarette as she flung her bag down onto a chair. Catching sight of Eunice, a twisted smile flitted across her face. "Good God, brother! Don't tell me that you found yourself a paramour!" She spat the word out as though it were a grape pip. Bomber addressed her with weary patience. "This is Eunice, my new assistant. Eunice, this is my sister Portia." She looked Eunice up and down with her cold grey eyes, but didn't offer her hand. "I should say that I'm pleased to meet you, but it would probably be a lie." "Likewise," Eunice replied. It was barely audible, and Portia had already turned her attention to her brother, but Eunice could have sworn that she saw the tip of Douglas's tail wag. She left Bomber to his odious sister, and tripped downstairs into the bright afternoon sunshine. The last thing she heard as she closed the door behind her was from Portia, in an altogether changed but still unpleasant wheedling tone. "Now, darling, when are you going to publish my book?" At the corner of Great Russell Street she stopped for a moment, remembering the man she had smiled at. She hoped that the person he was meeting hadn't left him waiting for too long. Just then, in amongst the dust and dirt at her feet, the glint of gold and glass caught her eye. She stooped down, rescued the small round object from the gutter, and slipped it safely into her pocket.
Chapter 4. It was always the same, looking down and never turning his face to the sky. He searched the pavements and gutters. His back burned and his eyes watered, full of grit and tears. And then he fell, back through the black into the damp and twisted sheets of his own bed. The dream was always the same. Endlessly searching and never finding the one thing that would finally bring him peace. The house was filled with the deep, soft darkness of a summer night. Anthony swung his weary legs out of bed and sat shrugging the stubborn scraps of dream from his head. He would have to get up. Sleep would not return tonight. He padded down the stairs, their creaking wood echoing his aching bones. No light was needed until he reached the kitchen. He made a pot of tea, finding more comfort in the making than the drinking, and took it through to the study. Pale moonlight skimmed across the edges of the shelves and pooled in the centre of the mahogany table. High on a shelf in the corner, the gold lid of the biscuit tin winked at him as he crossed the room. He took it down carefully and set it in the shimmering circle of light on the table. Of all the things that he had ever found, this troubled him the most, because it was not a something, but a someone. Of that he was unreasonably sure. Once again, he removed the lid and inspected the contents, as he had done every day for the past week since bringing it home. He had already repositioned the tin in the study several times, placing it higher up or hidden from sight, but its drawer remained irresistible. He couldn't leave it alone. He dipped his hand into the tin and gently rolled the coarse grey grains across his fingertips. The memory swept through him, snatching his breath and winding him as surely as any punch to the gut. Once again, he was holding death in his hands. The life they could have had together was a self-harming fantasy in which Anthony rarely indulged. They might have been grandparents by now. Thérèse had never spoken about wanting children. But then they had both assumed that they had the indubitable tenure of time. A tragic complacency, as it turned out. She had always wanted a dog. Anthony had held out for as long as he could, blustering about damage to the rose garden and excavations in the lawn. But she had won him round in the end, as she always did, with a fatal cocktail of charm and sheer bloody-mindedness. They were due to collect the dog from Battersea, the week after she died. Instead, Anthony spent the day wandering through the empty house, desperately gathering in any traces of her presence, the indent of her head on a pillow, Titian strands in her hairbrush, and a smudge of scarlet lipstick on a glass, paltry but precious proof of a life now extinguished. In the miserable months that followed, Padua fought to keep the echoes of her existence within its walls. Anthony would come into a room feeling that she had, only moments before, left it. Day after day he played hide-and-seek with her shadow. He heard her music in the garden room, caught her laughter in the garden, and felt her kiss on his mouth in the dark. But gradually, imperceptibly, infinitesimally, she let him be. She let him make a life without her. The trace that lingered, and still remained to this day, was the scent of roses in places where it could not be. Anthony brushed the grey powder from his fingertips and replaced the lid on the tin. One day, this would be him. Perhaps that was why the ashes troubled him so much. He must not be lost like this poor soul in the tin. He had to be with Thérèse. Laura lay wide awake, with her eyes clenched shut in fruitless pursuit of sleep. The worries and doubts that daytime activity kept at bay came sneaking back under cover of darkness, unpicking the threads of her comfortable life like moths on a cashmere sweater. The slam of a front door and loud voices and laughter from the neighbouring flat crushed any fragile hope of sleep that remained. The couple, who had moved in next door, enjoyed a busy and rowdy social life at the expense of their fellow residents. Within minutes of their return, accompanied by a dozen or so fellow party animals, the thin walls of Laura's flat began to pulse to the relentless throb of drum and bass. "Sweet Jesus, not again!" Laura swung her legs out of bed and drummed her heels against the side of the divan in frustration. It was the third time this week. She had tried reasoning with them. She had threatened them with the police. In the end, and rather to her shame, she had resorted to yelling expletives. Their response was always the same. Gushing apologies laced with empty promises, followed by no change whatsoever. They simply ignored her. Perhaps she should consider letting down the tyres on their Golf GTI, or shoving horse manure through their letterbox. She smiled to herself in spite of her anger. Where on earth would she get horse manure from? In the kitchen, Laura warmed milk in one saucepan to make hot chocolate, and with another she beat an exasperated tattoo on the party wall. A chunk of plaster, the size of a dinner plate, dislodged and smashed onto the floor. Shit! Laura scowled accusingly at the saucepan, still clenched in her hand. There was a hiss of burning milk as the contents of the other saucepan boiled over. Shit, shit, shit! Having cleared up the mess and heated some more milk, Laura sat at the table cradling her warm mug. She could feel the clouds gathering about her and the ground slipping beneath her feet. There was a storm coming. Of that she was certain. It wasn't just the neighbours who were troubling her. It was Anthony, too. Over the past weeks, something had changed. His physical decline was gradual, inevitable with age, but there was something else. An indefinable shift. She felt as though he was pulling away from her like a disenchanted lover secretly packing a suitcase, preparing to leave. If she lost Anthony, then she would lose Padua too. And together they offered her asylum from the madness that was the real world. Since her divorce, the precious few bearings that had set her course through life had drifted away. Having given up university and the chance of a writing career to marry Vince, she had hoped for children and all that motherhood would bring, and later, perhaps, an open university degree. But none of these had happened. She had fallen pregnant just once. The prospect of a child had temporarily shored up their already crumbling marriage. Vince had spared no expense and completed the nursery in a single weekend. The following week, Laura had miscarried. The next few years were spent doggedly trying to replace the child that was never born. The sex became grim and dutiful. They subjected themselves to all the necessary invasive and undignified medical interventions to determine where the problem lay, but the results were all normal. Vince became angry, more than sad, that he couldn't have what he thought he wanted. Eventually, and by then, to Laura's relief, the sex stopped altogether. It was then that she began to plan her escape. When she had married Vince, he insisted that there was no need for her to work, and by the time it became clear that she was not going to be a mother, Laura's lack of experience and qualifications were a significant problem when she began looking for a job. And she had needed a job, because she needed money. She needed money to leave Vince. Laura just wanted enough to get a flat and be able to keep herself, to slip away one day when Vince was at work and then divorce him from a safe distance. But the only job she could get was part-time and low-paid. It wasn't enough, and so she started writing, dreaming of a bestseller. She worked on her novel every day for hours, always hiding any evidence from Vince. In 6 months, it was complete, and with high hopes, Laura began submitting it to agents. 6 months later, the pile of rejection letters and emails was almost as thick as the novel itself. They were depressingly consistent. Laura's writing had more style than substance. She wrote beautifully, but her plot was too quiet. In desperation, she answered an advertisement in a woman's magazine. It guaranteed an income for writers who could produce short stories to a specific format for a niche publication which was enjoying a rapidly expanding readership. The deposit for Laura's flat was eventually paid for by an embarrassing and extensive catalogue of cloying erotica written for Feathers, Lace and Fantasy Fiction, a magazine for hot women with burning desires. When she began working at Padua, Laura stopped writing. The short stories were, thankfully, no longer necessary to provide an income, and her novel ended up in the recycling bin. She had lost all confidence to begin another. In her darkest moments, Laura wondered to what extent she had engineered her own failures. Had she become a habitual coward, afraid to climb in case she fell? At Padua with Anthony, she didn't have to think about it. The house was her emotional and physical fortress, and Anthony her shining knight. She poked with her fingertip at the skin forming on the surface of her hot chocolate as it cooled. Without Anthony and Padua, she would be lost. Chapter 5. Anthony swirled the gin and lime round in his glass and listened to the ice cubes tinkling in the colourless liquid. It was barely noon, but the cold alcohol woke what little fire was left in his veins, and he needed it now. He took a sip and then set the glass down on the table amongst the labelled bric-a-brac, which he had taken from one of the drawers. He was saying goodbye to the things. He felt small in the gnarled oak carver, like a boy wearing his father's overcoat, but aware as he was of his own diminution, he was not afraid, because now he had a plan. When he had started gathering lost things all those years ago, he hadn't really had a plan. He just wanted to keep them safe in case one day they could be reunited with the people who had lost them. Often he didn't know if what he had found was trash or treasure, but someone somewhere did. And then he had started writing again, weaving short stories around the things he found. Over the years, he had filled his drawers and shelves with fragments of other people's lives, and somehow they had helped to mend his, so cruelly shattered, and make it whole again. Not picture-perfect, of course not, after what had happened. A life still scarred and cracked and misshapen, but worth living nonetheless. A life with patches of blue sky amidst the grey, like the patch of sky he now held in his hand. He had found it in the gutter of Copper Street 12 years ago, according to its label. It was a single piece of a jigsaw puzzle, bright blue with a fleck of white on one edge. It was just a scrap of coloured cardboard. Most people wouldn't even have noticed it, and those who did would have dismissed it as rubbish. But Anthony knew that for someone, its loss could be incalculable. He turned the jigsaw piece over in the palm of his hand. Where did it belong?
Jigsaw puzzle piece, blue with white fleck, found in the gutter, Copper Street, 24th of September. They had the wrong names. Maud was such a modest little mouse of a name, quite unlike the woman who owned it. To have called her Strident would have been a compliment. And Gladys, so bright and cheery-sounding, it even had the word glad in it. But the poor woman it described seldom had any reason to be glad now. The sisters lived unhappily together in a neat terraced house in Copper Street. It had been their parents' house, and the place where they had both been born and brought up. Maud had entered the world as she had meant to carry on in it, loud, unattractive, and demanding attention. Her parents' firstborn, she had been indulged until it was too late to salvage any sensitivity or selflessness in her character. She became, and remained, the only person of any significance in her world. Gladys was a quiet, contented baby, which was just as well, as her mother could barely accommodate her basic needs whilst coping with the inexhaustible demands of her 4-year-old sister. When, at 18, Maud found a suitor almost as disagreeable as herself, the family breathed a collective and only very slightly guilty sigh of relief. Their engagement and marriage were enthusiastically encouraged, particularly when it transpired that Maud's fiancé would have to relocate to Scotland for his business interests. After an expensive, showy wedding, chosen and then criticised by Maud and entirely paid for by her parents, she left to inflict herself upon an unsuspecting town in the far west of Scotland, and life at Copper Street became gentle contentment. Gladys and her parents lived quietly and happily. They ate fish and chips for supper on Fridays, and salmon sandwiches and fruit salad with tinned cream for Sunday tea. They went to the pictures every Thursday night, and to Frinton for a week each summer. Sometimes Gladys went dancing at the co-op with her friends. She bought a budgerigar, named him Cyril, and never married. It wasn't her choice, simply a consequence of never being given the choice. She had found the right man for her, but unfortunately the right woman for him had turned out to be one of Gladys's friends. Gladys had made her own bridesmaid dress, and toasted their happiness with champagne and salty tears. She remained a friend to them both and became godmother to their two children. Maud and her husband had no children. "Bloody good job, too," her father remarked quietly to Cyril, if the topic were ever raised. As the parents grew older and frailer, Gladys took care of them. She nursed them, fed them and washed them, kept them comfortable and safe. Maud stayed in Scotland and sent the occasional useless gift. But when they eventually died, she found the funerals very upsetting. The contents of the post office savings account were divided equally between the two sisters, and in recognition of her devotion, her parents left their home to Gladys. But the will had a catastrophic codicil. It stated that if Maud should ever become homeless, she could live in the house in Copper Street until her circumstances improved. It had been kindly meant to make provision for a circumstance that her parents had believed to be most unlikely, and more easily included for that reason. But most unlikely is not impossible. And when Maud's husband died, he left her homeless, penniless, and speechless with rage. He had gambled away every asset they possessed, and rather than face Maud, he had then deliberately died. Maud returned to Copper Street an old woman-shaped vessel of vitriol. The peaceful, happy life that Gladys enjoyed was destroyed the moment Maud arrived at the front door, demanding money from her sister to pay the taxi driver. Untempered by any trace of gratitude, Maud invited misery as a permanent houseguest. With her accomplished repertoire of tiny tortures, she tormented her sister at every turn. She put sugar in her tea, knowing full well that Gladys didn't take it, overwatered the houseplants, and left a trail of mess and chaos in her wake. She refused to lift a finger to help with any of the chores, and sat all day growing fat and flatulent, eating fudge, doing jigsaw puzzles, and listening to the radio at full blast. Gladys's friends stopped coming to the house, and she went out as often as she dared. But her return was always met with a punishment, a precious ornament accidentally smashed, or a favourite dress inexplicably burned with the iron. Maud even frightened away from the garden the birds that her sister had lovingly fed by leaving out scraps for the neighbour's cat. Gladys could never disregard her parents' wishes, and any attempts to reason or remonstrate with her sister were met with disdain or violence. To Gladys, Maud was a death-watch beetle, an unwelcome parasite who had invaded her home and turned her happiness into dust. And she tapped. Just like a death-watch beetle, she tapped. Pudgy fingers tapping on the table, the arm of the chair, the edge of the sink. The tapping became the worst torture of all, incessant and invasive. It haunted Gladys day and night. Macbeth may have murdered sleep, but Maud murdered peace. That day she sat at the dining-room table, tapping as she contemplated the huge, half-completed jigsaw puzzle in front of her. It was Constable's The Haywain, a monstrous reproduction of 1,000 pieces, and the largest she had ever attempted. It was going to be her masterpiece. She squatted, toad-like, in front of the puzzle, a surplus of buttocks spilling over the edges of a chair, groaning under her weight, and tapped. Gladys closed the front door quietly behind her and set off down Copper Street, smiling as the wind whisked and twirled the crispy autumn leaves along the gutter. In her pocket, her fingers felt around the edges of a small scrap of cardboard, machine cut, blue, with a tiny fleck of white.
Anthony's fingers traced the edges of the jigsaw piece in the palm of his hand, and he wondered whose life it had once been a tiny part of, or perhaps not so tiny. Perhaps its loss had been disproportionately disastrous to its size, causing tears to flow, tempers to flare, or hearts to break. So it had been with Anthony and the thing that he had lost so long ago. In the eyes of the world, it was a gimcrack, small and worthless. But to Anthony, it was precious beyond measure. Its loss was a daily torment tapping on his shoulder, a merciless reminder of the promise he had broken. The only promise that Thérèse had ever extracted from him, and he had failed her. And so he had started to gather the things that other people lost. It was his only chance for atonement. It had worried him greatly that he had not found a way to reunite any of the things with their owners. Over the years he had tried, advertisements in the local press and newsletters, and even entries in the personal columns of the broadsheets, none of which had produced any response. And now there was very little time left. But he hoped that he had at last found someone to take over. Someone young enough and bright enough to have new ideas. Someone who would find a way to return the lost things to where they belonged. He had seen his solicitor and made the necessary adjustments to his will. He leaned back into his chair and stretched, feeling the hard wooden struts press into his spine. High on its shelf, the biscuit tin gleamed, burnished by early evening sun. He was so tired. He felt that he had overstayed his time, but had he done enough? Perhaps it was time for him to talk to Laura, to tell her that he was leaving. He dropped the jigsaw piece onto the table and took up his gin and lime. He had to tell her soon, before it was too late.
Chapter 6. Eunice. June 1974. Eunice dropped the keys of the petty cash tin back into their rightful place and closed the drawer. Her drawer. In her desk. Eunice had worked for Bomber for a whole month now, and he had sent her out to buy iced buns for the three of them so that they could celebrate. The month had flown past, with Eunice arriving earlier and leaving later each day, stretching her time in a place and with company that made her feel ignited with exciting possibilities. In those 4 short weeks, she had learned that Bomber was a fair and generous boss, passionate about his job, his dog, and films. He was also her matinee idol. He had a habit of quoting lines from his favourite films, and Eunice was beginning to follow suit. Her taste was more contemporary, but he was teaching her to appreciate some of Ealing Studios' finest, and already she had piqued his interest sufficiently for him to see a couple of newer releases at the local cinema. They agreed that Kind Hearts and Coronets was utterly marvellous, and Brief Encounter tragic. The Exorcist was shocking, but the spinning head bit hilarious. The Wicker Man chilling. The Optimists of Nine Elms magical, and Don't Look Now atmospheric and haunting, but with rather excessive exposure of Donald Sutherland's naked buttocks. Eunice was even considering the purchase of a red duffel coat, like the one worn by the dwarf in the film, and doing some haunting of her own. And, of course, The Great Escape was perfection. Bomber said that the wonderful thing about books was that they were films that played inside your head. Eunice had also learned that Douglas liked to go for a little stroll at 11 a.m., particularly if it took him past the bakery that sold such delicious iced buns, and that he always ate the icing first, and then the bun. And finally, she had learned that poisonous Portia was every bit as odious as a bowl of rotting offal. Bomber was in the kitchen making the tea, and Douglas was chivying him along by dribbling on his conker-coloured loke brogues in anticipation of an iced bun. From the window, Eunice watched the street below, today bustling with life, but only recently paralysed by a death. Pedestrians and traffic stopped in their tracks by a heart stopping forever before their very eyes. According to Mrs. Doyle in the bakery, Eunice had been there, but she hadn't seen a thing. Mrs. Doyle recalled the exact date and time and every detail of what had happened. As an ardent fan of police dramas on the television, she prided herself